Hello, and welcome to our In Conversation with Q5 podcast. I'm Jill Weeks. This podcast is the audio version of a webinar run by Anne Paul and Pavlina Kuvala of Q5 on the topic of what makes a healthy culture. For the conversation, Anne and Pavlina were joined by two guests, Sam Dunn and Rachel Gidman. Rachel Gidman is the Executive Director of People and Culture at Cardiff and Vale University Health Board. She led the workforce and OD operation for the Dragon Heart Hospital during the COVID pandemic. She also oversees all the strategic aspects of culture change, well-being, equality and inclusion within the organisation. Sam Dunn is a business psychologist, organisation development consultant and founder of Ealing Partners. His expertise spans areas including organisation and culture development, designing and delivering leadership development programmes, group facilitation and HR capability building. Sam has previously held senior leadership and organisation development roles in GlaxoSmithKline, Investec, GW Pharmaceuticals and Diageo. We have included in the notes copies of any slides which the speakers refer to. Over to Anne.
Welcome, Sam. Welcome, Rachel. It's lovely to have you with us today. Just to get us started this afternoon, I've got a kind of initial question for both of you. And it would be great just to hear a little bit from each of you about what culture is and why this topic is important in your perspective. So, Rachel, let's start with you.
Great. Thanks, Anne. Actually, it's quite funny thinking about this question and asking somebody who works in health and social care organisation. You'd ask somebody else down the road in the corridor, they'd say, a scientist, the cultivation of bacteria. But to you, so actually, no, really, for my perspective, leading the cultural agenda with my team in Cardiff and Vale, it's about I feel it's about a collection of attitudes and beliefs and behaviours, actually. And it's really important that the employees or the staff that you have know what part they play within the strategy, so they have a purpose. And wrapped around that purpose is the well-being at the heart of everything they do. So that's where I think those kind of elements are really important when you're looking at the culture.
Great. Thanks, Rachel. And my assumption would be that the whole well-being piece is even more important within your environment for a couple of reasons, and I'll test them out with you. So one is because if your colleagues aren't well, then they can't do their jobs. And secondly, because that's the whole purpose of your organisation. So again, it goes back to that whole idea of taking your own medicine and really valuing well-being as an important component of health.
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, this was pre-pandemic as well, Anne, you know, that people were tired, they were burnt out, the actual service was service delivery was increasing. So even more so now, the importance, and it's not just well-being. I think for me, it's the development, the well-being and the inclusion element. I think if you triangulate those three things, some people will feel that they belong in an organisation and they can work at the top of their licence and be authentic at work. So, but well-being, yeah, absolutely, that's paramount. And we used to say all the time about our patients, which is really important, but actually it's around our people. So it's the patients and our staff.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Rachel. Sam, let's hear from you then. So tell us a little bit about your view of culture and why it's a topic that you're passionate about.
Yeah, so my view of culture, so I think, and which is my way of explaining it really, I'm going to just go back 10,000 years for a second, so which really to me is explains why it's so important. So 10,000 years ago, when we were hunter-gatherers, if you weren't part of a tribe or a group, you didn't survive. You know, it was one of those realities. And you can look at the development of the brain, and that oldest part of our brain is concerned primarily with, am I in this group or out of this group? Because if we're out, the brain fires, the flight, fright, freeze, the feelings we have in our stomach kind of fire because we believe we're going to be excluded. So it's really, really important, a fundamental for us to believe we can belong. But then, so fast forward 10,000 years to organisations. To me, really, culture does two things. It's the glue that binds a group together and the theorists would call this internal integration. And to that point, really, about which we've already highlighted about integrating difference, a bit like in biology, if we don't have difference, we end up with, you know, webbed hands or what have you. So that's the first part. And then the second part is about adaptation. So a culture helps an organization adapt to the complex and changing environment that it's in. So it's that external adaptation. And the way that I frame it, and it's the best definition I've ever heard about culture, which is the smell of the place. And we all know, as soon as we go into, and in fact, I've coached a lot of people who say to me, I started a new job and I just knew on the first day it wasn't for me. We can just sense it. And to me, that's a great way of summing up culture, that kind of, that quite sophisticated shared meaning system that we can't quite describe, it, but we all feel. And to me, that's why it's so important.
Thank you very much, Sam. And that's really, really interesting, isn't it? That you do just pick up on these signals around culture instantly in terms of the conversations that you have with people and just what you pick up as you walk through the door. Interestingly, we ran a poll on LinkedIn in advance of this webinar and asked people whether they agreed that organizations require a healthy culture, and this is what we're going to go on to discuss in a minute in terms of what that means, but whether that they required this in order to thrive in the long term. And 96% of our respondents said yes, yes, it's very important, a healthy culture in that regard. You know, I think that this is a great topic for us to cover today because people are agreeing it does really, really matter. But Pav, over to you now for our first question.
Brilliant, great. Thank you for your initial thoughts. And let's dive a bit deeper. And if that's okay, Rachel, if we started with you and you talked about what culture means to you, and it would be great if you could help us understand the role that culture plays in the health sector and also in particular at the Cardiff and Vale University Health Board. What role does culture play for you?
Well, firstly, we haven't cracked it. It's a long journey, isn't it, with culture? And people, when we started our cultural piece of work and our learning from global, specifically around Canterbury, which I'll go into a bit more detail later, you know, you've got to start at some stage. So I suppose a few years ago before the pandemic, we decided this was the right way to go, to have that dialogue, to bring that relationship, to get individuals, a kind of a social movement on board. Part of our strategy, I always think about, you know, the janitor trying to put the man on the moon when he spoke to JFK on his visit. You know, it's about everybody playing a part within Cardiff. And actually, we've got 16,000 staff. And I know we've talked before, Sam, haven't we, that you've said, you know, there's cultures among cultures. So within clinical services, there'll be different cultures. So you've got to find the right culture for you. So what's the right culture for Cardiff and Vale, being a large organisation and a tertiary centre? So I suppose for me within Cardiff, you know, how do we build a high trust environment, reducing the bureaucracy, is very bureaucratic, the NHS. How can we try to lower those levels that the people closer to the patient care can feel empowered? So that was where we started, really. And you know, the importance of allowing individuals to make those decisions closer to the patient without all that constraint of red tape. We haven't quite cracked it all. We've got, and I know I've got colleagues around this table tonight, you know, and we're working through it. We're trying to be realistic, but we're trying to show action that will land with the organization rather than just talking about culture. What are the little bits of, you know, that long-term strategy that we've got, but also those small positive changes that individuals, our staff, our clinicians will say, gosh, if exactly what you said, not necessarily, you know, it feels different, it looks different, people are talking a different language. So I suppose we're at the start, well, three, four years into this journey, but a lot more to do.
Yeah, brilliant. And I assume also during COVID, it's become even more important, that empowerment, that understanding the role that everyone plays. And I assume that there's been, you know, everyone was tired, high pressures, trying to overcome all of the challenges. So back to what Sam said before, that glue, bringing everyone together and making sure that we're, you know, we're all in this together, we can support each other. I assume it's been really important for you in this.
I think, yeah, we were one of the only health boards that didn't go into a gold command because we felt that was a Gold Command for a short period of time of a crisis. We thought the pandemic was going to go on for a little while, and here we are 2 years on. And it worked. You know, the start of the culture work about empowering the clinicians played out, actually. They worked at pace. They were talking to colleagues globally, you know, finding the best practice, talking, that relationships being closer together. But what happened? We had one purpose. We had one spinning plate, and that was COVID. I suppose the challenges now are that we've got hundreds of spinning plates. So actually, right, how do we keep that and we don't revert back?
Yeah, really interesting. And also, you know, it seems like the pandemic was a big challenge, but there's so many more to come. It's the way we need to work now. We need to constantly adapt. It's going to be another challenge thrown to us. So how do we keep some of that magic that, you know, unfortunately came through COVID? But what are the good things that you can keep out of that to continue to keep that glue together?
Yeah, we did some discovery phase about what's gone well and what's gone well and what's not gone so well. And then the people were saying, you know, staff were saying, well, now we're going back into a little bit more of silo working. And I'm saying to them, but you're the same people. So why, you know, don't let it happen. You know, let's just so keep the good parts. But yeah, in a big organization, it is trying to get that hearts and minds, actually getting people invested in the so what? What's the purpose? And why should I? We're tired. We're exhausted. Why should I play? You know, we've worked really hard over the last 2 years. How do we keep the momentum? And again, the role modeling from us as executives, we're very much about we support you. But we empower you to do the right thing rather than telling individuals what to do.
Absolutely. Lovely. Great. Thank you. And Sam, if we also go to you now, and you've been working with many different organizations across different sectors, supporting them in their culture journey. Why do you believe, from your perspective, culture matters so much?
I think it matters so much because it's central to everything an organization does each day, and particularly if I think about healthy cultures, which you were talking about. And to me, healthy cultures are entirely dependent on the organization. So there isn't an archetypal healthy culture. It depends entirely on the kind of history, the heritage, and the purpose of the organization and what they are there to do. What I have observed, I think, are three things that organizations tend to do well who have healthy cultures or maintain healthy cultures. And that's they've got the ability to self-reflect. And you'd be amazed how many big organizations don't have that ability. So to bear witness or to hold up a mirror, to listen. And by that, I don't just mean to listen to employees, but I mean listen to clients, customers, stakeholders, patients, whoever the group might be. And then the third thing is to process. And by process, I mean dialogue. So the ability to have this dialogue. So those three things, the ability to self-reflect, listen, and have constructive dialogue, puts organizations in a good position to develop healthy cultures. I think the other thing I'd say is context is key. And this is a point that often gets missed in culture work. So if you think of an organization that you've worked for, where you might feel constrained, unhappy, lacking empowerment, and so on. It's just not, you're not feeling great. And then in another organization you've worked for, you feel inspired and trusted and confident, empowered, happy, all of those great things. You're the same person. The only difference is the context. And again, I think culture is so important because, and the organizations that get it right, they understand it's about creating the context and the conditions for people to be successful within that environment. So for example, innovation. If you think about innovation, a lot of organizations get this wrong. They develop behaviors around culture. So they say, these are the new behaviors. This is what we want you to do. Off you go and do it. And nothing changes, again, because the context hasn't changed. So if one of those might be innovation, instead of saying, go innovate, here are the behaviors, what you need to think about is, how do we create an environment, a working environment that produces new ideas? How do we fuel thinking? How do we celebrate innovation? How do we incentivize it? How do we create the headspace for it? How do we get tech to support it? And so on. That's an example of how you create those conditions. And then the final thing I'd say is embrace the dark side. Too often in cultures that can become unhealthy, they focused on the positives only. And what I mean by that, there's a classic therapy question, which you can try later. When you open up the fridge, you can ask yourself, what looks good to me versus what looks good for me? And they're two entirely different questions. And too often in culture work, we ask the question, what looks good to me? What is it we want? Versus what looks good for us? What do we need? And we are in corporate, a lot of us in corporate environments, commercial environments, and they can have a brutal side. And it's about acknowledging that and not hiding it, I suppose.
Yeah, really interesting point. It also seems that sometimes we don't even open the fridge to ask those questions to ourselves. And so we kind of set it to the side. We think that we have, you know, bigger challenges to overcome, and there might be some behaviors that are blocking us from achieving our objectives, but it's okay, we have more important stuff to deal with. And at some point we realize how important opening that fridge, you know, holding the mirror to ourselves and actually understanding what is it that is holding us back, what are some of those behaviors that we actually need to tap into, really understand where are they coming from and what can we do about them.
Yeah, do you know, it just reminded me, I worked in an organization where when I joined, there was fresh milk in the fridge. And by the time I left, there was old UHT milk that we had to use. And it showed that steady decline in what it was like to work there. And I finished up working in a porter cabin without any running water, without a coffee machine.
Yes. And you also mentioned kind of with your definition about what does culture mean, you mentioned those two kind of great words about that internal integration, that glue that you said, and also that external adaptation. Do you want to talk to us just a bit more about that external adaptation? What does that look like?
So it's the idea that the world is constantly changing and we need to adapt to stay still. I call it, this is made up by me completely, but I call it the Fred Perry principle. So Fred Perry was a tennis player who won Wimbledon in 1936. And if you put Fred Perry in a time machine and put him into Wimbledon now, he'd be in his long trousers smoking a pipe with a wooden racket and he wouldn't win a point. Yet in 1936, he was an example of excellence. And so to me, that adaptation is the world, cultures, tribes, communities need to constantly reinvent and be able to adapt to circumstances, sometimes just to stay still. But unfortunately, when we do something well, and definitely in organizations, we do something well, so we do more of it and we become blinkered and we lose that ability to say, you know, what is it we need to look to reinvent, or where's the culture changing, or where doesn't it feel quite right? And the bit that makes it more difficult is this integration piece. So again, 10,000 years ago, if I met you on the plane, I needed to immediately decide, are you a threat? Are you going to hurt me? And there's a number of questions I'd want to check from you. And again, in organizations, when we have new people in the organization, we have those same questions. So we need to integrate that so we become a team and then we can adapt to what's going on.
And it's kind of, you know, more important than ever, that adaptation, that being able to tackle the challenges, to survive, to thrive. You know, something that might have worked today might not work in 2 months' time. So that's, it seems it's becoming more and more a key skill that is required across the organization, the ability to adapt and stay resilient as well.
Yeah.
Anne, over to you.
Great. Thank you, Pav. And Sam and Rachel. So we've started talking about this a little bit, but really we want to explore this idea of organisation health and particularly healthy culture. Sam, you've said this already, that actually what denotes a healthy culture really, really depends on the organisation, the circumstance of the organisation, the history of the organisation. I think legacy is really, really important in this work, and the strategic goals of the organisation. And so each culture needs to be unique. And certainly, I mean, I've had lots of conversations over the years about culture where people have said, we want to have a culture like Netflix, or we want to be like Google. From my perspective, that's not going to be helpful, because what Netflix and Google are doing is different from what this organisation is trying to achieve. And so the culture really, really needs to align with the strategic intentions of the organisation and its purpose. But having said all of that, we do think that there are some common characteristics that are signal a healthy culture. And some of them have already come up in the conversation. But Ollie, if you could perhaps put our slide up, slide 3, that would be great. And we'll take a look at this. We think that the unique culture is absolutely critical. But however, there's some common themes that we see through in the organizations that we work with, where we think that those organizations are healthy, they're achieving their strategic goals, and the people in the organisation still have fresh milk and are not in a porter cabin with no milk. So these are psychological safety. So this whole idea of encouraging people to speak up with their ideas, questions, own mistakes, and that's creating a safe environment for them to do their best work. The second is a growth mindset. So creating an environment where people can challenge, they can innovate, they can learn and they can grow. Resilience. So, you know, this has certainly been a word that we've talked about a lot more in the last couple of years, probably than ever before in relation to organisations. But the degree to which the organisation can deal positively with challenge and setbacks at an organisation level and at an individual level within that organisation. Fourth one we think is adaptability. And so, again, this is really, really come up, I think, in the conversation that we've just been having. Organisations need to be able to flex to those circumstances, to flex to that constantly changing context. And I think it's fair to say that the organisations that have done well over the last couple of years were the ones that were able to adapt quickly to the new context that was created as a result of COVID, and the ability to respond with agility to external factors while still keeping an eye on the strategic goals of the organisation. So this isn't about an organisation culture that flip-flops in response to everything that's going on externally, but that is able to adapt while still keeping on the pathway that's been set. Finally, inclusion, and this is something again that's already cropped up. I think, Rachel, you talked about inclusion a little while ago. So how do we create within the organisation this sense of belonging that means that people show up at their best? Goes back to your point, Sam, about people kind of really feeling that they're in that group, that they're part of something, and that as a result of that they feel able to be themselves and do their best work, bring their best contribution. That's our view, along with all the unique elements, that these are the things that we think kind of consistently show up in organisations that are healthy and that have a healthy culture. And just a quick plug for the Menti, because we're asking in the Menti poll for people to tell us which of these they think is most important. So it would be great to have a look at the results of that at the end of our session today.
I love these, by the way, because I was thinking about is imagine if you had a nameless organization, imagine if one of these didn't exist, how long do you think it would survive? And it just answers it straight away. So when I was talking about conditions, that's these. It's like, if we have these things present, then the actual culture, which we, you know, exist, we know it's going to stay healthy. So I think these are really helpful.
Yeah, thank you. And I think also that the one of the reasons why I quite like these is that, well, obviously I really like them, is because culture can be quite a nebulous topic. And I think that these offer some kind of quite concrete starting blocks from which organisations can start to reflect on their own culture and start to think about the degree to which these are apparent or not in the culture of the organisation, how they show up, how they don't show up, and then start to kind of build on top of that to create that unique culture story for them. So they can be used as a sort of the blocks for that. But Sam, you know, you've said you like this. Is there anything that's missing from your perspective? What would you add to our list?
I don't know if I'd add anything to the list, actually, of those. I think if you had those in any kind of given organisation, you'd have that ability, as I've talked about, to integrate difference. Yeah. You've got with inclusive, resilient, adaptable, and then adapt to the external world. So, no, I think they're really, really, you know, good pillars, if you like, to focus on.
Great. And so let's move to Rachel for a minute. Rachel, how do these play out within the health sector and at Cardiff and Vale? And are there any that you would are particularly important or that are missing from your perspective that you'd add to our list?
I suppose for me, we talked about it at the beginning around the well-being of our staff. So our staff feeling that we're looking out for them. It's a non-blame culture. We're supporting those individuals. So not just about having those well-being interventions, but it's actually the whole ethos of wrapped around. So I think I would probably actually put well-being separately and right at the top of the list, really, about our staff and looking after our staff, because that's then I think they'll feel included. They'll be more agile. And I think, you know, all of these will follow, you know, so definitely the well-being one I'd probably add.
Great, thank you. And on that well-being piece, I mean, what you said there was lovely. You said this is about having a well-being ethos, not just interventions. Can you give us a flavour of how you've created that well-being ethos and brought that to life so that your colleagues really do experience that?
Yeah, so there's lots of work that my team are doing around, first of all, actually, exactly what Sam said, we actually went and listened. So we took 6 months into the organisation, halfway in through the pandemic, to really find out on the ground, you know, what it was like to work day in, day out for our sort of population. So we did have a lot, you know, some of it was hard hearing. You know, people's, it's not just about well-being, it's not just about physical, it's obviously about mental, it's about financial well-being, even more so now with our cost of living. So we listened, and then it was really important then we talked as a team about the interventions that we would put through this and how we were going to evaluate them, but actually how are we going to close that loop? Because, you know, historically, yes, we listened, and then no action. So actually then people lose the confidence in yourself and again that trust, isn't it? So I think for us it was really about, yes, we have an occupational health system and we have a well-being service, but actually we were listening and it was like, I can't get a glass of water. That's fundamental. You know, let's get these 10 water fountains. And you're thinking, I can't believe we're saying this in our generation. Refurbishments of our staff rooms. But actually, because we're moving our staff a lot, you know, different wards and things, let's get a format that if you're in a staff room, it's looking the same wherever you go. So the sort of the decoration and the painting, etc. And then we started creating staff havens. And actually from that now we're talking about collision spaces. So these collision spaces are going to be collaboration that like-minded people who have innovative ideas or improvement ideas could actually recuperate in one corner, but really spark off light bulb moments in another. So we're starting to create these collision spaces that people can grab a coffee, have those, you know, discussions. So I think it's about, for me, the well-being is around listening, really enacting the practical things as well as the strategic side of things. You know, I'd love to have a retreat for Wales that, you know, all of our staff could go to within Wales and the NHS in Wales. But, you know, that's something to mature to. But again, it's about listening because, like you said, it's got to be right for your business. Got to listen to your staff and make sure it aligns to your purpose to make it work and be a positive.
Brilliant. And I love that. I love the use of collision there as a word because it has so much energy in it, doesn't it? It really, really does. It's more energetic than collaboration, which is probably the usual word for it. I think that's great. It sounds really dynamic. So thanks, Rachel, there. And thanks, Sam. So we've started to sort of gradually move into the question around how. So how do we achieve a shift in culture within organisations? So Pav, I think you're going to pick this up next.
Brilliant, yes. So we've started with the why. We went into the what and explored the key characteristics that enable the environment of a healthy culture. And we started to go into the how. So let's deep dive a bit into that how. And Sam, if that's okay, if we can go to you. And as we said, we kind of supported the culture journey of multiple organizations. So from your experience, what have you seen organizations do that has resulted in that shift in their culture? What is it that has worked particularly well and why? Because we tend to, you know, hear from clients and many people say, you know, it's an abstract thing. Where shall I start? It's really difficult. It takes years to shift a culture, and it's a bit of an ambiguous term to unpack and understand. Where shall we start to make a change happen? So let's kind of break it down and hear from you. What are some practical things? How shall we go about embedding that?
Okay. Yeah, no problem. I'm going to start with what not to do, because it's a particular bugbear of mine, which is avoid mouse mats with values printed on them at all costs. Although I've seen in my career many, many, many cultural efforts which revolve around the printing of values and then kind of plastering them everywhere. And the organisations I work with, I could maybe say there's probably 10 values that most organisations all share and have similar ones. You know, so none of these are different. So I guess the starting point for me is, however you describe your culture, it has to be true, it has to be absolute, and it has to be agreed and understood. Because if it's not, then what you're doing is, you know, using mouse mats, you're doing a marketing exercise. I've seen many conferences with leaders who've been given a script to read out and say, this is our new culture. And everyone in the audience is sitting there thinking, well, you don't live and breathe that. And then the other thing I think is really sort of one of the fundamentals is build it from the bottom up. I've seen organizations, again, start at the top, say, this is our new culture. And of course, it doesn't work because the culture exists. So unless you're a completely new organization, you have a culture already, and it will have developed, evolved out of that necessity to survive and adapt. So what you have will be your current best version of the unwritten rules for what your organization needs to do to be successful. But then I think you can change culture. And again, I'm going to go back to this changing the context piece. And so I think there's lots of different levers or areas that you can look to make a change with culture. So leadership, you know, leadership and the role models, and absolutely removing those leaders that aren't role models. I've seen many a culture initiative undone by leaders who are countercultural but are left to exist in the organization. And, you know, and things like, for any of you that have got kids, you know that if you tolerate a behavior, it becomes the accepted behavior. If you let something go, I've got a 3-year-old and I know that only too well. So you need to be really hot on behavior and how you're going to deal with countercultural behavior. But then, you know, things like, how do you recruit people? Because recruitment's the, you know, these are the new people in your tribe. Are you recruiting for culture? Induction is, that's the one I'd have in flashing neon. So I work for an organization where, and I imagine none of you will have experienced this, the executive came for 3 hours to every induction. And they sat on stage and they said to the audience, we want you to interrogate us and give us as hard a time as you can about what you think it's like here. Because they knew that these were the people entering the organization and they wanted them to really want to be there. And then, you know, you've got your, make sure your policies, your procedures match up, how you select leaders, how you develop them, how you reward people, you know, your performance system. Again, I've seen performance systems that reward behavior. I've often seen this, you've kind of got a leadership model here, and then you've got your culture and a descriptors here, and the two things don't talk to each other. Teamwork, I think team process, team dialogue, team building, team coaching is probably the most significant way you can start to build that sense of community across an organization. And interestingly, just back to the well-being point, I read a book recently by a guy called Dr. Christopher Ryan. And in it, he says, the best predictor of how long any of us are going to live is not whether you drink or smoke or exercise or what you eat. It's whether you're a part of a community where you feel loved and that you feel someone's got your back. That is a brilliant description of why culture is important. I mean, and that's why I say team, focus on team, because it's create a place where we feel safe, to that psychological safety of one of the Q5 key ingredients, where we feel safe and accepted, then that's a great starting point. And then finally, and there was an organization I worked for who were the absolute role models in this, is they had cultural processes that exemplified and perpetuated the culture. And again, I'd never seen this. So every team, regardless of level, you know, place in the organization, they went away for a day to give each other feedback once a year and to fix their, or to look at their strategy. And then, and this is the brilliant bit, this is genius. Whenever a new member joined the team, or there was a new team in its entirety, they spent a day storytelling, and they, each person would have an hour or 2 hours to tell their story. And when you do that with people, they go, no, 2 hours, I can't talk about myself. And you say, well, if you've lived for 30, 40, 50 years, 2 hours is not much. And that process of allowing people to share, at the end of it, you've got a bond and you've got a psychological safety and a trust that I just never seen anything like it. But in most organisations, when you say we're going to do that, they'll say, well, can we just do introductions 5 minutes at the start and then crack on with the agenda? And so to me, it's this, a lot of this is common sense. It's just treat each other as human beings, take the time, get to know each other, and then put all your, you know, your organizational levers to create the right context.
In the new era of kind of hybrid working, it's even more important to make sure that you build those connections, that you have that sense of community, that it's people feel that belonging, they feel safe to share. Because we've heard from many clients the fact that, you know, the meetings are becoming more and more transactional. You know, sometimes we lose that, just that informal, you know, let's share, let's have a bit of a conversation. So it's really important. How do we, in a kind of this new hybrid model, ensure that we really, as you say, place at the heart that sense of community and we that team development, and we see it as a really important factor into embedding the right culture?
Do you know, I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's a real puzzler to figure out how we can do that and, as you say, create the right level of community and intimacy and engagement. But it's what I really don't know the right way to do it at the moment.
And I think, yeah, at the very basic, it's recognizing that it's needed and it should be a priority. I think many times it's left to the side and we think that it's not as important as other business priorities. By recognizing the importance of it, then it might have different forms, different shapes, depending on, you know, the team, the organization, the culture, but at least recognizing how important that is key.
I often think about my next door neighbors who are in their 20s and they work at the end of their, one of them works at the end of the garden. And I think their career is going to be spent in a shed at the end of their garden. You know, what a prospect that is. And you know, and I just feel really sorry for them, but that's the reality for a lot of people now.
And just to also go back to your point about those values on a page, how do you truly embed them into the processes, into, you know, throughout the employee life cycle, right from the very start of, you know, recruitment to how do we reward people? Do we incentivize, for example, if we are kind of after collaboration, do we actually incentivize? Do we performance manage? Do we reward people for collaboration, or do we kind of reward for individual performance? So right through all of the people processes, how do we make sure that we truly live the values? Lovely. Rachel, shall we also hear from you? So you started sharing with us about the how you went about embedding your kind of culture change in Cardiff and Vale. And you mentioned about that listening part, which was really important. If you were to share a bit more about, you know, in addition to the listening, then next, what are those steps that you took after that, taking the chance to really listen to the comfortable and possibly, as you said, the less comfortable elements that needed to be heard? What did you do? What other steps did you take?
First of all, I just want to build on what Sam said, because it's really important what we're bringing into the organisation from Professor West's and his compassionate leadership principles. And a lot of people will be sceptical, you know, 16,000 staff, is that the sort of huggy kind of, cuddly kind of compassion? But actually it's very courageous. It's about really looking after people and that sort of emotion. So I completely agree with what Sam was saying and building that throughout all of the system. So actually, although I said we listened, we've done lots of listening. And I suppose our journey started pre-pandemic, where we really, as an organisation, to be transparent about everything we're doing. You know, we've got our Welsh government close with us in the city. We wanted to be very open to listen from staff that were struggling, you know, and wasn't going right, or the freedom to speak up sort of processes. So there's lots of elements, the recruitment and the value-based recruitment and appraisal approach. So there's loads of different sort of, it's multifaceted, isn't it, what you've got to do. But I felt language was really important to start to get a brand around the people and culture plan. And our sort of journey started when we went to learn globally from New Zealand and Canterbury, because they had a very similar geographical area, the population that they served, very similar to us in Wales. And so we actually had I was fortunate to go out to listen, to look, to learn, to actually test it out, to actually go to staff. is this right? You know, are you highly trusted? I went for one evening, said to the CEO, how do you sleep at night? Because your staff are saying that, you know, you'll come down to support them, but you're not on top of them. You're not smothering them. And he said to me, look around you, Rachel, there is data everywhere. If I see that A&E is a huge, you know, pressure there, I can see the data and I will go down to support them. But otherwise, they're empowered to do their job. But what was really important when I came back to Cardiff was not to lift and shift the New Zealand model to Cardiff, because some of them were quite bizarre. And I would say it's not going to work. And I've worked in the organisation a long time as a clinician myself previously. So it was really about what is the Cardiff and Vale way? So we started to have what is the leadership side of that? What is the improvement, the innovation methodology, and try. And we're still on this journey. So I don't want to sit here and say, oh, yes, we've done it, because we haven't. We're still pushing through. And I think for myself and the team, we've built a people and culture plan. So I think, Sam, I invested in a day with my team last July, and it was the best day investment to really reflect, to really sit back and say, where have we been? For goodness sake, it's been a whirlwind. But let's look at the direction. What is the next sort of 3 years? And every one of them were on board, and all our peers around us were looking, going, is Rachel a little bit crazy? You know, why are we not looking at the here and now? She's talking about building new workforce models and we're talking about the well-being of staff. But actually, you've got to start. You've got to look at your future. And now, talking to clinicians, talking to staff, yes, you will have those people who are skeptical, but you've got to continue to keep that vulnerability, that curve to make change. You've got to make people feel a little bit vulnerable, but with the support around them. Key messages for me from an exec level is being present. If I've got a title of people and culture and I'm sitting in my ivory tower, then there's something wrong. So I'm out and about listening, talking to staff, putting action in place. You know, I was talking to staff in the emergency unit the other day, and it's huge amount of pressure, and saying, what would make your day better tomorrow to ultimately affect patient care? And it was development. They were oozing development. We just need to be more study, but on the ground, we feel like we've de-skilled potentially. And they haven't, but they just feel that the pace that they're working through. So I think for us, it was looking globally, learning lessons from others. How does that enact into your organization? How do you become a high trusting environment, giving permission, letting go some of your authority and saying, we're behind you. We give you permission to make things better. And actually the main purpose, reminding people. So I think the hearts and minds, why are we here? All of us in health. It's about patience. So reminding. So we have a character known Wynne. Wynne is a 72-year-old gentleman with early onset dementia. I bet many of you know Wynne. He could be your neighbour. He could be a family member. He could be in your rugby club. And again, it's about what's the best thing. So rather than starting a conversation about how much more money or the limited amount of money we've got, or we've always done it this way, what is the best thing for Wynne? We know our constraints and then we'll work around those. So going back to that common purpose and that language. And it's amazing what a hashtag does. So people and culture now, everywhere we're out, whether that's leadership programs, EDI work, whether that's people analytics, we're hashtagging people mm-hmm. and culture, and people are starting to use that language. Very exciting, but I think I'm here till my retirement to hopefully crack it.
Brilliant. Yes. And as you said, there might be small things that actually can have a huge impact that we hadn't even realized. So, yes. Brilliant. OK, so we're going to share a couple of tips from our side, too. We've mentioned quite a few already, so some of them are just emphasizing those points. But Rachel, I would 100% echo what you said about, you know, you mentioned we haven't cracked it yet. We're still pushing through. And actually, you know, that's at the essence of it. You will never crack it. We constantly need to iterate, to adapt, to try, to learn, to listen, and to try something different next time. So it's a journey. It's a dynamic journey that we need to go through. And it's not a plan that we set up in year one and we follow through for 3 years. It constantly needs that iteration and testing what works and what doesn't work and what do we need to adapt along the way. an open approach. We've heard a lot today the word listening, the word kind of staying true, making sure that it's bottom up, Sam, you mentioned. So that's all kind of sums up to that. Use an open approach rather than the executive team in a room together deciding what are the values and the underlying behaviours. How can you bring the workforce along the journey? How can you get them excited? How can you get them to shape that so they can then feel more ownership and greater accountability and actually embedding that as part of their day-to-day role, and they truly know what role they play into bringing that healthy culture to life. Third one, and I think Rachel, you also mentioned it around, you know, leadership as role models. We've seen leaders say one thing and then they say, yeah, that doesn't apply for me. It applies for everyone else. So it absolutely needs to be leader led. There needs to be alignment at a leadership level around how do we need to show up? What are we responsible for? And so that can have then a ripple effect in everyone else in the organization. So absolutely leader-led, but also employee-delivered. We've mentioned empowerment a lot today. So how do you empower everyone in the organization to feel that sense of ownership, to feel that they can contribute into shaping that culture and embedding it truly as part of how we work? Grounded in real work challenges. So that's something that comes up a lot with our clients. So what are, we encourage them to think about, what are the one, two things that are core that you can start with and really build momentum, show some tangible results as a result of that. So what are two key things to start with and build that momentum, and start with that, and then back to that iteration, then pick something else, learn from it and evolve it. And also kind of going through that journey of embedding your culture and developing your culture, it's a brilliant development opportunity. You know, people pick up some brilliant skills around, you know, problem solving together, creativity, influencing, resilience. So there are so many other skills that through this journey can be so useful for the organizational performance, and to be able to, as we said, back to Sam, your external adaptation that are so important in order to stay successful in this new world of work. So a couple more to kind of to add from us, but we've touched on all of these, and I think it's a lovely way to kind of bring it into a practical framework at the end. And conscious that we also need to see a chat and respond to some of the questions. So over to you to cover some of the questions that we're having coming through.
Could I answer Jigar's one? So it's in organisations going through large transformational change. Where does the burden of cultural change lie? Should it come from senior exec co-leadership that role model the change they wish to see? Or are there other approaches, frameworks to consider? And I think the answer is yes to all of it. So But the bit I was going to share was, I think your exco role modeling, owning and leading it is vital, and it has to fit with the strategic direction of the company. And if you've got shareholders, what the shareholders want and so on, and what the market's saying. But I love this idea. I call it a slice, like a pizza slice through the organization. So I've seen great pieces of culture work where the exco will do some work and be facilitated. And then you take a slice of all levels through the organization, or all areas through the organization. And then they do the same work. And then the two come together and they build a final version. So it kind of brings together that strategic, this is what we're hearing from the market. And then you've got the reality in the organization. So if you can get support to do both, it takes an exec co that are quite willing to not have all the answers, I suppose, and to learn. But that's how, you know, just one way of doing it.
Great, thank you.
How that played out, really. So when we decided before the pandemic to start this piece of work, it was around designing a piece of organisational development, a programme of getting people, the first 80 involved. And actually the exec sponsored 10 people per table. And it was really interesting because this is when I was the assistant director of organisational development, and I designed the programme. First day was about learning from industry, but could be transferable into health. And the second day was about health, but we had no agenda. And actually everybody was quite twitched. I knew the design, I knew the sort of process, but everyone was like, where's the agenda? It was like, we've always had an agenda before, or a pre-meet before a meet. And actually the 80 thought leaders started to build the answers to where we were going. And actually they're quite of our, they're our sort of thought leaders and coming in. And the idea that we hope to cascade is to get that social movement, that those 80 invite 10 more people to get on board and to cascade it that way. So that's just a bit of an example around our Amplify work.
Perfect. Amazing. Thank you for sharing that and for really bringing that to life. So we've got 5 minutes left. I'd really like us to, well, we've got a couple of things to do. It would be great to answer one more question that's in the chat. So Ollie, I'll be inviting you in a minute to select one of those for our panelists, and they'll have to give us a very quick answers. And then we'll have a quick look at the results of the Menti that we've been doing before we finish off. So Ollie, can you give us one more question, please?
I can indeed. And this one comes from Leanne, and it's all around employee experience is different from one person to the next. How do you create a healthy culture that suits everyone working in the organisation? Or is it impossible to take everyone on the journey?
Great question. Who'd like to have a go at answering that one?
I don't mind coming in. Oh, Sam, do you want to go? You took breath. I'll just do my first inner thoughts of that was actually, it's got to be different for everybody. It's got to have the same common purpose. But if we've got to embrace diversity, haven't we, as well, to actually have like-minded people all the same is not going to work. We need that diversity, that inclusion side to really. So we can build a culture where we want to go in a direction that we want people to come on board and the values and behaviours. But I think everybody needs to bring that alive themselves. And then that's when innovation and improvement will happen.
Great. Thank you, Rachel. I think there's also an element for me in, and this might be slightly controversial to bring in the final 4 minutes, that individuals need to take a degree of responsibility as well for themselves. And so we all have the right to self-select in terms of the environment that we're in. And if the culture isn't quite right for us, then either we can try and shift it and shape it in a positive way, or look for the culture that is right for us as well. But I do think that if we try and cater for everybody, we'll cater for nobody. But as I say, it might be too controversial, but a little bit too late in the day for that. So let's have a quick look at the Menti results. Ollie, if you could flash those up. So, brilliant. So I was unsure whether we'd actually get just a complete flat line across all of them, but we can definitely see that psychological safety is coming out as the most important, followed by inclusivity. So it'd be great. Sam, let's just hear from you. Any reactions to that? What do you think?
I'm not surprised thinking about it. And just actually to the last question, I think if you've got psychological safety, and if because it's not something you can give people, it's something that people feel. And if you've got people in your organisation that feel it, they're going to be free to express what they want and what they need and how they want it. So, I'm not surprised, actually.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to begin to close the session there. First of all, a massive thank you to Sam and Rachel for joining us today. I mean, I really hope the audience have enjoyed the conversation. It's been fascinating from my perspective. I thank you both for your sharing your philosophy, giving us some interesting ideas, and also sharing your practical tips as well. I think that there's absolutely heaps for us all to take away and think about from today's conversation. Thank you also, Ollie, for doing all of the behind the scenes stuff, and to my lovely colleague, Pav, as well. That's it from us today. Thank you all very, very much for joining us.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you would like more information on how Q5 can help you design, develop, or implement your approach to creating a healthy culture within your organisation, please email info@q5partners.com. And do look out for the other episodes in this series, which are available on the Q5 website. Thank you and goodbye.